This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hi, this is Jannat Jalil from the Global News Podcast. We're following the widespread condemnation of President Trump's proposal that the US should take over Gaza, expel the Palestinians there, and turn it, in his words, into a Riviera of the Middle East. Join us to hear the day's top stories from BBC News, delivered twice a day on weekdays, daily at weekends. Search for the Global News Podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. Now, if one of Donald Trump's ambitions is to dominate news coverage around the world, well, he certainly achieved that today with his startling announcement last night that he wants the United States to take control of the Gaza Strip and turn it into what he called the Riviera of the Middle East.
The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip and we will do a job with it, too. We'll own it and be responsible for dismantling all of the dangerous unexploded bombs and other weapons on the site, level the site and get rid of the destroyed buildings, level it out, create an economic development that will supply unlimited numbers of jobs and housing for the people of the area.
In the meantime, though, the people of the area, the Palestinians, would be encouraged to move elsewhere, to neighbouring countries. "I believe we can resettle," were his words. Well, this extraordinary proposal was made during a news conference at the White House with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who, you won't be surprised to hear, warmly welcomed it.
I mentioned again tonight our three goals, and the third goal is to make sure that Gaza never poses a threat to Israel again. President Trump is taking it to a much higher level. He sees a different future for that piece of land that has been the focus of so much terrorism, so many attacks against us, so many trials and so many tribulations.
Well, at a news conference in the past couple of hours, the White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt didn't rule out the forcible transfer of Palestinians. She was also asked how the president's proposals aligned with his America First policy, which is against involvement in foreign wars.
The president has not committed to putting boots on the ground in Gaza. He has also said that the United States is not going to pay for the rebuilding of Gaza. His administration is going to work with our partners in the region to reconstruct this region. And let me just take a step back here, because this is an out-of-the-box idea. That's who President Trump is. That's why the American people elected him. And his goal is lasting peace in the Middle East for all people in the region.
Caroline Leavitt, but the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned in the past hour against what he called ethnic cleansing in Gaza.
In the search for solutions, we must not make the problem worse. It is vital to stay true to the bedrock of international law. It is essential to avoid any form of ethnic cleansing.
And so what about Gazans themselves? Well, I've been speaking to Abir Barakat. She's an English lecturer and she lives in Gaza City.
It's absolutely absurd and crazy. All of these statements that he's giving to the press, this is so funny, coming from Trump, who always have been a strange person in his diplomacy, or let's say undiplomatic ways to express his policy. But no one is actually happy about what he's saying. And we are sure that hopefully nothing of this plan that he's presenting is going to be implemented, because the people of Gaza are steadfast in this place. We are not leaving our ground. We are not leaving our land. And we are here to stay, not to leave.
So assuming that he does try and press ahead with this plan, what do you think would happen if American troops came in and tried to move people, perhaps to Egypt, perhaps to Jordan, but move people out of the Gaza Strip? What would happen, do you think?
Do you think that the American troops are going to come in just like what they did in Iraq or Afghanistan? Do you think this is an easy task to do? Of course, their mission will fail because people here are resilient to the land. We are here to stay. We are deeply rooted on our land. And they will fail the same way as they failed in Vietnam, the same way they failed in Iraq and Afghanistan. So Palestine has people who are very stubborn. And they believe in their mission. They believe in their right to stay in this land. We believe that we are the rightful owners of this land.
But do you think people would try and defend their right to stay in Gaza by whatever means necessary?
Yeah. By the way, armed resistance is not only exclusive to Hamas or Jihad. We have also the Fatah groups also here who believe in this cause. We have other smaller factions than Hamas and Jihad or Fatah. They would still come together and stand up to protect their people and their family.
Isn't he right to say that, you know, most of Gaza has been destroyed by the war? I think the UN estimates that nearly 70% of buildings don't exist anymore. There's clearly a lot of unexploded bombs and other ammunition around. Somebody needs to sort that out, don't they? Because at the moment, I mean, it's not really habitable for all 2 million Gazans, is it?
I'm sorry to laugh. So suddenly he fears for the lives of people from the pollution, from all of these unexplosive things around. And because if they are afraid for the health of the people and for their sanity or for their lives, they shouldn't have sent all of these explosives, tons of explosives to Gaza.
He also wants to turn Gaza, he seemed to suggest, into the Riviera of the Middle East, a sort of seaside resort. I mean, when you hear that, what do you think?
Wow, it's funny. It's really funny. So Gaza has been all over the course of history, has been a place that has been destroyed many times from all these people who came and left. If he didn't read history about Gaza very well, he should read it right now. So now he wants to turn it into Dubai. Why now? Well, we all know that Trump is a businessman more than a politician. Or a diplomatic person. So I don't think what he's proposing here is applicable or can be done.
Do you know anyone who has said, look, actually, given the state that Gaza is in at the moment, maybe I wouldn't mind living somewhere else, perhaps for a bit, for a few years while they rebuild Gaza? Has anybody, any of your friends or colleagues or family said, you know, maybe life would be better somewhere else?
For some people, that would be applicable. The majority of the people here in Gaza or from my society, from the people around me, they say we are not leaving our land. And if you just listen to them or hear them, they will tell you we are not repeating the mistakes of our ancestors who were expelled from their land in 1948. And I have even published two articles about that, making a comparison between myself and my grandmother. And I have stated that clearly, that I'm not repeating the mistake of my grandmother. Now, my father has been displaced to the south during this war. I asked him when he came back to Gaza, are you going to go out again or to any place else if anything else happens like October 7? He said, no, I'd rather die on my spot rather than to leave.
That was Abir Barakat, English lecturer living in Gaza City. Well, I've also been getting a view from the US, from Aaron David Miller, former State Department advisor and negotiator on the Middle East in both Republican and Democratic administrations, now a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment, a foreign affairs think tank in Washington, D.C. I asked him first if this proposal from President Trump would fly.
No. To say it's dead on arrival, it's probably a very bad image, given the extent of what Israelis and Palestinians have done to one another over the course of the last 15 months. No. In fact, the White House is walking it back. They now argue the president never committed U.S. troops. And number one, this relocation, this population transfer, this voluntary departure, whatever it is only to be temporary. It has no chance of succeeding. Having worked for Democrats and Republicans for 27 years, the Carter administration through Bush 43, we came up with some pretty strange ideas, but nothing that I have seen. nothing that I have seen in those 27 years on the part of a Republican or Democratic administration even comes close.
On that, though, can I just
how wrong this policy, this articulation is?
Can I just ask you this? On that, you talked about strange ideas. Is there any merit, do you think, in putting forward radical ideas, however controversial, given that up until now, past ideas about how to bring peace to the Middle East haven't worked?
Well, this isn't about that. I mean, a truly transformative idea would be welcomed. It requires leadership.
Well, Benjamin Netanyahu, in the clip that we heard, seems to suggest that it would bring peace to Gaza.
No, but I mean, anyone who has ever spent any time in Gaza or in the region understands that what the president has proposed violates every political law of gravity that is informed, for good or ill, the impasse in this conflict. And it strikes me as extraordinary that in one fell swoop, with the Prime Minister of Israel standing next to him, looking like the cat who swallowed the canary, the president has basically associated his administration with an approach that could be easily construed as population transfer, or worse, undermined relations with Cairo and Amman, burdened his own aspiration for Israeli Saudi normalization with a DOA proposal, and validated the right wing and right wing fantasies of extremists in Israel. And I might add, sent an unmistakable message to every authoritarian who wants to listen. I'm thinking Putin and President Xi, that, hey, all you got to do is state your territorial aspirations and assert control. No, there is nothing, in my judgment, the way this proposal was framed, that makes it not just doable, it is dangerous.
Could it have a negative impact on the Gaza ceasefire at the moment?
It could have a negative impact by emboldening the right wing on one hand and basically handing Hamas a propaganda coup. I mean, Hamas, having visited through the October 7 attack, death and destruction on 2.3 million people of Gaza, courtesy of the Israelis, now have a way back to energize the population. Your previous guest, it's Samud, it's steadfastness, it's resistance. No, this was an unserious proposal by an unserious man, and I might add, I worked for Republicans and Democrats. I voted for Republicans and Democrats. This is not a partisan comic. The line between, for American foreign policy, shouldn't be between left and right, liberal or conservative, or Republican or Democrat. It should be between dumb on one hand and smart on the other. And this proposal is just plain dumb.
And that was Aaron David Miller, former State Department advisor on the Middle East, as he mentioned, in both Republican and Democratic administrations. There is much more on this story. There's a live page up and running on our website. And in the past hour or so, our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, has written his piece of analysis on Trump's Gaza plan. He thinks it won't happen, but will have some serious consequences. It's all at bbc.com/news. You're listening to NewsHour. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. When Google was founded, its first motto since dropped was "Don't be evil." But those days, some argue, are long gone, and it has also now dropped a long-standing ban on artificial intelligence being used for developing weapons and surveillance tools. The move was defended by Alphabet, Google's parent company, as being necessary to support national security in democracies. But it's raised profound concerns among campaigners and human rights groups. Arthur Holland-Michel is an author and journalist covering military AI. He's a research partner at the Peace Research Institute in Oslo, in Norway. How significant does he think this move is?
Well, James, this is a sad thing to say, but in a way it was inevitable. Google was already providing cloud computing services to the IDF, and all of its peers in this space had already said in the last few months and years that they would be willing to build military AI and have started taking steps in that direction.
So the Pandora's box is already open, is it?
Yes, but it's still important because Google really was the last major holdout among tech companies that originally pledged not to put AI in weapons. And ironically, Google was actually the reason that those pledges really existed in the first place. It created the sort of first major tech company pledge not to put AI in weapon systems back in 2018. So it's not just practically important, it's actually a huge symbolic shift, a kind of end of an era of tech companies resisting governments and instead are going to help them in ethically questionable ways.
Yeah, and what about its defense that, you know, it should be democracies leading the development of AI to support national security? I mean, what do you make of that? Is it a bit disingenuous?
It could be a sly marketing ploy, but whether that's the case or whether it reflects genuine convictions, it feels like a very dangerous thing to say. And I should say that it's a common argument among all the tech companies that are now jumping into AI development, because to say that democracies will depend on AI for defense creates this logic for policymakers that they cannot afford not to build AI. And from a lobbying perspective, that is, of course, a very effective rhetorical tool. But it also creates this arms race dynamic where militaries are really rushing faster and faster because of the sort of enormous perceived stakes of getting left behind. And by encouraging it, companies that sort of throw their weight behind this idea are not helping sort of simmer down that dynamic.
And I guess it also assumes that those countries where the tech companies are based will always be democracies. Just briefly, in the minute that we've got left, I mean, what are the concerns about AI in defense? Is it a lack of accountability, the danger they might go rogue?
It's all of that. It's also the fact that we know just from interacting with AI on a daily basis, it doesn't always work very well. It hallucinates. It can be jailbroken. It's very hard to see how it operates or why it does what it does. And when you're talking about putting that on a weapon system, yes, it can cause terrible accidents. People will die as a result. And it'll be hard to know why the system did what it did, which is not good for democratic militaries that want to preserve, you know, the precepts of international humanitarian law.
That was Arthur Holland-Michel, who's an author and journalist covering the military uses of AI. Now, war zones can be rebuilt, and Mosul in Iraq is a good example. Today, historic buildings in the city reopened after years of reconstruction work. That followed the devastation wrought by ISIS and the fierce battle to dislodge the jihadists back in 2017. The rebuilding's been organised and funded by the UN's cultural arm, UNESCO. More than 1,300 local young people have been trained in traditional skills, while some 6,000 new jobs were created to carry out the work in the old city. Our Middle East regional editor, Sebastian Usher, has this report.
The bells of Al-Tahira Church ring out across Mosul, a symbol of the rebirth of the old city that was left devastated 8 years ago after the battle to drive ISIS out.
It was like a ghost town, dead bodies around, sickening smell and horrible scenes of the city and the skyline without the Hadba Minaret. The cityscape is full of rubble. And the River of Tigris, one of the most joyous places around town.
A Mosul photographer, Ali Al-Barudi, recalls the horror that greeted him when he first entered the old city shortly after the street-by-street battle was over in 2017, with the gloriously skewed Al-Hadba Minaret, known as the Hunchback, that had been emblematic of Mosul for hundreds of years, in ruins.
It was not the city that we knew. It was like a metamorphosis. We never imagined that, not even in our worst nightmares.
80% of the old city of Mosul and the west bank of the Tigris was destroyed. It was not just the churches, mosques and old houses that needed to be repaired, but the community spirit of those who'd lived there for so long in relative harmony between religions and ethnicities. A year later, the huge task of rebuilding began under the auspices of UNESCO, with a budget of $115 million that the UN Cultural Agency had managed to drum up, much of it from the UAE and the European Union. Father Olivier Poquillon, a Dominican priest, returned to Mosul to help oversee the restoration of the convent of Notre-Dame de l'Heure, known locally as Al Sa'a, which was founded nearly 200 years ago.
We started by the beginning, trying first to gather a team composed of people from old Mosul, from different denominations, Christians, Muslims, working all together. That was the first challenge we had to face. And that was probably the greatest achievement. Because if you want to rebuild a building, you've got first to rebuild trust.
In charge of the entire project, which included the restoration of 124 old houses, has been the architect Maria Rita Akatozo, who came to Mosul straight from restoration work for UNESCO in Afghanistan.
I hope the reconstruction can bring back hope in the affected communities and can favor the recovery of their cultural identity and memory. I think this is particularly important for the young generations grown up in a situation of conflict and political instability.
8 years on, the major landmarks of Mosul are restored. The wriggling minaret of Al-Hadba, the convent, the church of Al-Tahira, and the complex of Al-Nouri Mosque. And people have been able to return to the houses that have in some cases been home to their families for centuries.
My house was built in 1864. Unfortunately, my house was destroyed partially during the Mosul Pearl Liberation, and it was unsuitable to live, especially with my children. So I decided to move to my parents' house. I was very pleased and exciting to see my house rebuilt again.
After the UNESCO rebuilt my house, I came back. I can't describe the feeling I had, because after seeing all the destruction that happened there, I thought I will never be able to come back and live there again.
The scars of what the people of Mosul endured are yet to heal, just as much of Iraq remains in a fragile state. But the rebirth from the rubble of the old city represents hope for a better future.
That was Sebastian Usher reporting. You're listening to NewsHour. Do stay with us. Lots more coming up.
Hi, this is Jannat Jalil from the Global News Podcast. We're following the widespread condemnation of President Trump's proposal that the US should take over Gaza, expel the Palestinians there, and turn it, in his words, into a Riviera of the Middle East. Join us to hear the day's top stories from BBC News, delivered twice a day on weekdays, daily at weekends. Search for the Global News Podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Let's head to Sweden now. And the scene of Tuesday's mass shooting at an adult education centre in the city of Örebro. 11 people were killed in the attack, including the gunman. The BBC's Europe correspondent Nick Beek is there.
I've spent most of the day, actually, James, at the adult educational college where this shooting took place, the worst in the country's history. And there has been a steady stream, really, of people coming to lay flowers and pay tribute to those who were killed. Among the mourners, people coming to sort of stand in silence and contemplate this crime, were the King and Queen of Sweden and also the Prime Minister. And they spent a bit of time talking to people. I think they were basically trying to send a message that things would be okay. It was a message of reassurance after 24 hours that I think have really, really shocked people here.
What more do we know about the suspected gunman and of course, his motive?
Yes, the motive is still not clear more than 24 hours on. The police have given very limited information. I think either they're not willing to share that or simply they haven't been able to build up a sufficiently clear picture and profile of the killer. Swedish media have been reporting in the past couple of hours that the gunman was a 35-year-old man, a local. They say he was called Rickard Andersson, And there are various reports characterizing him as somewhat of a recluse, a loner who'd lost contact with his family. The police haven't confirmed this, though. There has been a search of one particular property here in the city. But in terms of a motive for this individual named, it's not clear at all. The police have said that they don't believe the perpetrator was involved in gangs, that he was driven by any sort of ideology or terrorism. So in that regard, very little information still.
And Nick, what about the victims? What do we know about them and also those who were injured and are receiving treatment?
Again, we haven't got a huge amount of detail about the people who were killed. We're told at least 10 people were killed yesterday. In terms of the victims, we don't know their backgrounds. Worth pointing out there, James, this was a school, an educational centre, where people came in the most part to learn Swedish. So they were new arrivals, immigrants to the country. And a number of people we spoke to today made this point. There were lots of other schools around here, elementary schools, different types of educational facilities. But this was the one that was chosen. And so, for example, I spoke to one 16-year-old student, Ishmael, and he thought there was a real racial element to this. That was his fear, that it had taken place, this attack, at a college where people were from different backgrounds, had come from abroad, and were trying to learn Swedish and make Sweden their home.
The BBC's Nick Peake reporting there from Örebro in Sweden. You're listening to NewsHour. This is NewsHour live from the BBC in London. I'm James Menendez. Let's head back to Washington, D.C., because it's not just America's long-standing Middle East policy that's been upended by the new administration. President Trump's apparent fondness for disrupting, even bulldozing through existing ways of doing things has been felt across government. A federal agency, USAID, created by Congress, has effectively been shuttered and subsumed into the State Department. Mr. Trump also tried to freeze congressionally approved spending, including most foreign aid. That was frozen by a federal judge. And he's used his powers as head of the executive branch of government to nullify laws such as the ban on TikTok. And Elon Musk, his advisor and the world's richest man, has been using his position as head of the new Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, to try to fire federal employees and, it seems, to comb through federal payment systems. Well, here's Musk on stage at Donald Trump's Madison Square Gardens rally just before the election, speaking to Howard Lutnick, head of the Trump transition team, and promising huge cuts.
How much do you think we can rip out of this wasted $6.5 trillion Harris-Biden budget?
Well, I think we can do at least $2
trillion. Yeah!
Yes.
$2
trillion. Your money is being wasted, and the Department of Government Efficiency is going to fix that.
Well, although a U.S. president and his administration enjoy considerable powers, has Donald Trump already overstepped the mark? I've been speaking to Andy Rudilevich, who's professor of government at Bowdoin College in Maine. First of all, was the dismantling of USAID legal?
Well, the short answer is no. USAID was created in statute, separated out from the State Department by law in the 1990s. It has funding that requires it to do certain things. It carries out a mission that Congress declared in law for it to do. And so, yeah, I mean, the president is breaking the law if he does not spend the money via the routes that Congress has set up in law.
And yet, it seems to have already happened. Does that mean that the checks and balances that we're always told exist in the U.S. system aren't working?
Well, yes, they're certainly under strain. Congress could react. That's hasn't foreclosed that possibility, but certainly the relative blasé attitude of the Republican majority in Congress towards the president's actions is problematic. The framers of the Constitution assumed that Congress would push back, that it would defend its own institutional prerogatives against all comers, and that simply hasn't happened here.
And it has happened in the past, hasn't it? Even when, for example, there's been a Republican president and a Republican majority, for example, in the Senate, that Senate and that Congress has always guarded its responsibilities carefully, hasn't it?
It has, and the power of the purse is really fundamental to the identity of Congress as an important independent check. And as a policymaker, for that matter, you know, the Nixon years saw perhaps the fiercest battling over these same kinds of terrain. At that point, President Nixon had claimed similarly that he could shut down agencies. He didn't have to spend money that Congress had appropriated. Congress pushed back. They specifically made such actions illegal. The Supreme Court, in a couple of cases, has supported that position. And so this seemed to be a dead letter for about 50 years. But now the Trump administration has come in and effectively said, well, so much for Watergate, Nixon was right, and has acted effectively on the same legal theories that Nixon put forth and theories that were discredited back then.
And what about Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE? The fact that that exists as a sort of agency within the executive branch, does that have legal status?
Yeah, when DOGE was first put forth, a lot of people thought it would be a advisory committee of some kind, similar to those that have been created in the past to do the same kind of job, to advise the president on ways to make government more efficient. Instead, what the president did in, you know, day one or two via executive order was to merge DOGE into an existing office inside the White House, inside the Office of Management and Budget, which is a very powerful agency that helps the president control the executive branch. Now, that makes DOGE employees government employees with the requirements for transparency and avoiding conflict of interest that that entails. So we haven't had any kind of information on how this is supposed to work. Certainly, the executive order that the president issued only contemplated that DOGE would be working on technical issues like IT and computer systems. That's, you know, shutting down government agencies, shutting off government payments. That's not in the executive order, certainly.
And thinking about possible conflicts of interest, we've heard that Musk's team has had access to some Treasury payment systems. Given that his businesses receive money from the federal government in the form of investments, I mean, one can see that there might be a conflict of interest there. Is that fair?
I think it is. Mr. Musk has apparently been named as a part-time advisor, a special government employee. That comes with its limits. You can only work 130 days a year, and you're not supposed to play a major policy role, unquote. If you do, then you are subject to all the same disclosure laws as regular federal employees. Even if he's only a special government employee, even if he wasn't playing a policy role, he'd be forbidden from participating in any matters that affects his financial interest or the interests of his companies. And, you know, if he's really sitting on top of this flood of personal and corporate data, it's very hard to see how he's avoiding those conflicts.
Given all that we've been talking about, I mean, what do you think is going on here? Is it a President Trump flush from victory in the elections, testing the boundaries of executive power and seeing how far he can push that power, and perhaps waiting to see whether it will be curtailed by Congress or perhaps the courts?
Well, I think that's accurate, but I also think it's true to say that he has leapt over the boundaries of what is legal and what is not. I don't want to just say he's sort of ambitiously testing the boundaries. He's actually crossed those boundaries with regards to the letter of the law in a whole number of areas, not just with regards to whatever DOGE is up to. But fundamentally, the president has sworn an oath to defend, protect, preserve the Constitution. He's sworn an oath to faithfully execute the law. And it's hard to see how he's doing those things when he is violating the letter of the law.
So how can he be held to account apart from, well, in fact, there will be no another election in which he will have to face the electorate, will there?
Right. Well, if we're looking that far ahead, we could look to the midterm elections of 2026, where you might see Democratic majorities returned, especially in the House. But, you know, the most immediate reaction presumably will be individual court cases that are brought. We've seen those be successful against a couple of the president's executive actions so far. The federal employees' unions are suing over some of DOGE's activities, I believe. But really, again, this comes down to Congress and its responsibility as a branch of government to push back in favor of its own constitutional prerogatives. If it fails to do that, if it acts more like a parliamentary majority than an independent branch of the government, then we have strayed some way from our constitutional system of checks and balances.
Andy Rudilavige, professor of government at Bowdoin College in Maine. In Georgia, a journalist who's been on hunger strike in jail for the past 3 weeks has been taken to hospital. Mzia Amaglobeli, the founder of two independent online news publications, was arrested last month and charged with assaulting a police officer. The EU Human Rights Commissioner and 14 foreign embassies in Georgia have all called for her release. Critics of the government say Amaglobeli's detention highlights Georgia's rapid democratic decline. The BBC's Rehan Dimitri has travelled to her hometown of Batumi in western Georgia and sent us this report.
No justice, no peace. Police is everywhere, justice nowhere. A group of protesters are shouting outside the constitutional court in the Black Sea town of Batumi, western Georgia. Here, just as in the capital Tbilisi, anti-government protests have been going on for over 2 months, demanding fresh elections. Now they want freedom for a local journalist. Freedom to Mzia, they chant. Mzia Amaglobeli, whose large photo is printed on a banner at the rally, is the founder of the leading independent online media here, Batumelebi. She is currently in pre-trial detention, accused of assaulting a police officer. In protest, she has gone on hunger strike. I've come to the offices of Batumelebi, where I'm meeting one of his journalists, Irma Dimitradze.
Yeah, this is about when we got the international prize, Batumelebi.
Really? Irma tells me how the newspaper was founded in 2001 by Mzia Amaglobeli and her friend Eter Turadze, both in their 20s at the time. Later, they launched a nationwide online platform called Net Gazeti. Today, these two publications are among the most trusted and reliable news sources in Georgia's highly polarized media scape. Irma explains what happened on the day of Mzia's arrest.
It was just yet another day of protest. Mzia doesn't attend the protests. As a CEO of the organization, she's always busy. She's spending most of her time in here, in this very office where we are right now.
On January the 11th, several people were detained in Batumi for putting up posters calling for a general strike. Among the detained was a friend of Mzia's, so she went to the police station to find her. In footage from that time, Mzia is seen sticking a poster to a police building and immediately police detain her. Later, after being released, something happens between her and the chief of the Batumi police. She grabs him by his sleeve and appears to lightly touch his face. This time she is detained and charged with assaulting a police officer. It's punishable by up to 7 years in prison. Her lawyers allege while in detention, the police chief spat in her face, denied her access to water and a toilet. Several days later, the Batumi City Court remands Amaglobeli in pre-trial custody. The case has become national news. The country's Prime Minister, Irakli Kobakhidze, personally got involved, describing Amaglobeli's action as a crime against the state.
Raising a hand against a policeman should be punished as severely as possible. What's the intention of people who conduct this type of violence against police officers? They want to destroy the state.
Was sent out on.
In Batumelebi's office, Irma reads out the letter which Mzia sent from prison announcing her hunger strike.
The reason I stand accused today is the direct consequence of the repressive, treacherous, and violent processes unfolding over the past year. Processes that seek to silence individuals, suppress free speech. I will not bow to this regime. I will not play by its rules. I'm on a hunger strike. There is something greater than life itself, freedom.
Protesters in Batumi sing Georgia's national anthem, which glorifies freedom. Mzia Amaglobeli's hunger strike is a reminder to many here how fragile their democracy has become.
That was Rehan Dimitri reporting there from Georgia. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. It is the middle of winter in the Northern Hemisphere, but on Sunday, temperatures at the North Pole soared more than 20 degrees Celsius above average. Actual temperatures inside parts of the Arctic Circle were close to zero, ice's melting point. So what caused this winter heatwave? A question for Carlo Bontempo, Director of Europe's Copernicus Climate Change Service.
Ultimately, it was caused by an advection, as we call it, a warm advection. So warm air from the mid-latitude or even the tropics moving north in this case, and so bringing temperature that are unusual for that part of the world, well above the historical averages in that region. So that's basically a low-pressure system that is centered around Iceland that is sucking up the air from the lower latitude and bringing it close to the pole.
And warm sea temperatures in the North Atlantic, are they also a contributory factor?
Well, we are moving in a very different climate from the historical climate, and we are indeed seeing temperature that all over the globe are very different from the historical level. At this moment in time, actually, the Pacific, which has been controlling to some extent the part of the record we have seen over the last couple of years, the Pacific is cooling a bit. We are close to La Nina, not on the edge of La Nina definition, but the rest of the global ocean are still very warm. And so indeed, having these air masses above warm ocean means that these air masses themselves are warmer and can contribute to increase the temperature well above the averages.
And a long way above the average, more than 20 degrees Celsius. How unusual is that?
In our record, this is not necessarily fully unprecedented. Jumps like that happen. We do know that the climate in the mid-latitude and northern region has this large variation, much more than tropical areas. So it's possible that this has happened or similar jumps have been seen before. But clearly, the absolute value, you know, having a jump of 20 degrees is quite extraordinary. So it may have happened another time in our historical record, but not very frequently at all.
Okay. And what are the consequences of such a high temperature at this time of year? I mean, is it enough just to cause a little bit of ice melt, even though it's midwinter?
Well, you're absolutely right. We are in the middle of winter. We don't expect this temperature above freezing, even in the Svalbard or in the European Arctic region. At the same time, a single event per se may not be sufficient to trigger a major de-icing or loss of ice. At the same time, this year, we are already at record low level. So if you look at the extension of sea ice in the Arctic in this January 25, we are below than any previous year. And the fact that you have these large events could actually exacerbate, at least in the short term, the current situation.
Carlo Buontempo of Europe's Copernicus Climate Change Service. Blow away the cobwebs. That's Paranoid by Black Sabbath, who today announced that they and singer Ozzy Osbourne will reunite for one last time to play a fundraising farewell gig in Birmingham, their hometown, in July. The heavy metal pioneers will headline a one-day festival featuring a whole host of bands that they inspired, including Metallica, Slayer and Anthrax. Ozzy Osbourne had largely retired from playing live after injuring his spine and also the onset of Parkinson's disease. I've been talking to rock journalist Ian Winwood, author of Bodies, Life and Death in Music, and I asked him first for his reaction to news of the reunion.
Well, the thing is, James, I'm getting on a little bit, so I can remember back in 2007 when Led Zeppelin announced they were doing a one-off charity concert at the O2 Arena here in London. And I thought that would be the biggest rock kerfuffle, hard and loud rock kerfuffle of my lifetime. But this has proved me wrong. I think this is at least the equal to that. It's really set the pulses racing among people that like this kind of thing.
Okay, so we can quote you on that. The greatest heavy metal kerfuffle of all time.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I do. I think so.
I've never heard it described as a kerfuffle. I thought heavy metal rock was meant to be something harder than that.
Yeah, perhaps kerfuffle, not quite the right word, James, but it's certainly a commotion. Let's put it like that.
Why do you think they're doing this? I mean, what's the rationale behind it? Because, you know, Ozzy Osbourne hasn't been in the best of health. Is this just a chance to really say goodbye for the final time?
I think, as music journalists and as media people, we learn to become cynical. But it's not for the money, because the proceeds from the event are being split along three charities, two children's charities and one Parkinson's charity, which is a condition from which Ozzy himself suffers. You're right about his declining health. So I think it's more sentiment and what will doubtless be an emotional farewell. I mean, it's certainly geographically apt. The band's very first practice was at a community centre in Aston.
Yeah, so coming home, and also a chance to have the original lineup. Because I think when they last had their supposed farewell show back in 2017, there was a different drummer, Bill Ward, the original drummer. He wasn't there, and I don't think he's played with them for 20 years.
20 years, and that was somewhat less honourable, because that falling out was about money, and it was about how much, if indeed anything, it was reported Bill Ward would be paid for his efforts on that farewell tour. They've had a number of farewell gigs, that should be remembered, but the last farewell gig was at the NIA Arena, also in Birmingham, but that lineup only featured three of the original members, and this is the full set.
It's also about getting all these other bands and metal stars together. I mean, it's potentially quite a lineup, isn't it?
It's like the Live Aid of loud music, really. It's incredible. And this is, I think, where it's really, really significant, James, because the lineup is kind of a who's who of loud music. Metallica, I mean, Slayer, Pantera, and younger bands such as Sleep Token. And all of those bands, it might be that Sleep Token were inspired by some of the older bands who were then inspired by Metallica, but the source is Black Sabbath.
Ian Winwood, journalist and author on Black Sabbath getting back together and their legacy on rock music. That is just about it for this edition of NewsHour. As I mentioned earlier, keep up to date with all the latest on our top story, Trump's proposals for Gaza, on our website, bbc.com/news. But from me and the rest of the team, thanks so much for listening. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Until then, bye-bye.
Hi, this is Jannat Jalil from the Global News Podcast. We're following the widespread condemnation of President Trump's proposal that the US should take over Gaza, expel the Palestinians there, and turn it, in his words, into a Riviera of the Middle East. Join us to hear the day's top stories from BBC News, delivered twice a day on weekdays, daily at weekends. Search for the Global News Podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.